Ghosts of Christmas past, hospitality and events industry hit again as Neffet warns Omicron could cause 15,000 cases a day. We talk to immunovirologist Professor Liam Fanning. We'll talk to the Hotels Federation, who say cutting wage supports while tightening restrictions is a hammer blow to the sector. Leaks about leaks. Ministers demand Neffet get government approval for media appearances. The National Parents Council on that massive reaction from parents over mask wearing in primary schools. And does the MICA scheme offer 100% redress for homeowners or not? Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, Colin Brophy, Minister of State for Overseas Development Aid and Diaspora. Jennifer Whitmore, Social Democrat spokesperson on climate, environment and biodiversity. And Donal Brin, Sinn Féin spokesperson on housing, local government and heritage. You can text us on 51551, email saturday@rte.ie or tweet to @SaturdayRTE. Now, that Neffet letter to government makes for stark reading in relation to the Omicron variant. If Omicron becomes dominant before January 6th, as Neffet has modelled for, we could, they say, have cases in the range of 6,000 to 15,000 a day after Christmas. I'm joined on the line now by Professor Liam Fanning, immunovirologist at University College Cork. Good afternoon, Professor Fanning.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Those restrictions that were rolled out again last night, Professor Fanning, do you think they'll do the trick? Do you think they're enough to hold back this threat from the Omicron variant?
Well, I suppose only time will tell, but there's no doubt that reducing people's movement and mobility and sociability will drive down numbers. Look, there are so many unknowns with regard to Omicron. You know, we don't know if we're facing a foe that's going to replace Delta and cause more disease, or will it replace Delta and cause less disease. So I suppose we're in that kind of in-between kind of phony war period at the moment, where we don't know what our foe really is going to present to us. And we're planning so that we would be ready if it presents us with quite a challenge.
There's questions being raised, Professor Fanning, about the science behind some of these reimposed restrictions. Like, some of them do seem to date back to the time where we thought being close to somebody was the most dangerous thing, whereas now, of course, we understand a lot more about how this virus is spread through aerosols and how it's basically anywhere, if you're anywhere in a room where somebody is breathing out this virus, that you could be at risk.
So I suppose the aerosol really is the, and the air transmission, the capacity of this virus to be transmitted through air, is one of the big worries really. And we all know now that HEPA filters are particularly good at removing this virus from the air. And that's why they have been recommended in schools. I know that some people have bought them privately for their own schools. But it's really the removal of it from an enclosed environment is what protects people in that environment. So, you know, if you have it in schools, you think of it like, I heard an analogy during the week, which was particularly good, was the filter in the fish tank. And that ultimately all air gets filtered through it, the viruses get trapped in it, and it cleans the air and reduces the amount of virus in that air. So that science is fairly robust. The science behind mask wearing is that if you have it, it prevents you from or reduces you from transmitting it onwards, both because it catches the droplets and electrostatic catch by the actual mask itself. Mm-hmm. And if it's tightly fitting from you inhaling the mask. So that science is actually quite robust with regard to kind of indoor acquisition of COVID-19.
But isn't the issue is that we didn't hear anything about ventilation yesterday or about HEPA filters?
No, we didn't hear anything yesterday. You're quite right about that. And the HEPA filter discussion with regard to schools has been kind of much discussed, but it appears as if there's been little effective or impactful action on it with regard to HEPA filters. I heard a figure that it would cost roughly about 80 million to put HEPA filters into school, but I would posit that in the context of 40-odd billion that we've spent, that actually is a rather small amount of money with a very large dividend. And in fact, with the reductions in in-class transmission and onward bringing it home to individuals, it might actually pay for itself, which is kind of an economic benefit to actually keeping parents at work.
Yeah, and I think actually some people are putting it as low as 12 million to fit the amount of the number of HEPA filters that might be required. But just one last question in relation to that. When you look at particularly the hospitality sector restrictions that have now been reintroduced, such as, you know, limiting the number of people at a table, there are questions being asked about people about, again, what point is that really going to, you know, what good is that going to do if people can breathe it in from 10 tables over?
No, Dan, that's a very legitimate question. And, you know, again, maybe the likes of air filtration systems in restaurants and that would actually, you know, make these more safer in places where we could actually socialise a bit more. So, you know, I don't think the full scope of what can be done has been done. So, and, you know, we are in winter and, like, we can't have, you know, pubs and classrooms at 6 degrees, you know what I mean? Like, from a learning perspective, you know, children can't learn when they're not comfortable. And we're not going to socialise as adults in an environment that's actually cold. So, you know, we have solutions, but it just seems as if they're not being implemented.
The other prong on this attack, of course, from a government perspective, is the booster program. Are we getting booster vaccinations into people's arms fast enough?
Okay, well, what I'd say, I think, is, you know, with regard to boosters, is that I think there's an acceptance now that the booster campaign was probably a bit slow off the mark, and that we should have been at it maybe 4 to 6 weeks before we started. So, because we have seen the effect in Ireland, which is no surprise, given that that effect of a positive outcome on reduction in infections and reduction in the number of hospitalizations was seen by Israel, that data was very robust, very strong, scientifically validated and peer reviewed. You know, we were very slow with regard to that aspect of it. We have achieved, I think, 60% only of the eligible population, and that's the over 60s. And in the 60 to 69 year old group, there's only 25% of the eligible population boosted. We haven't even touched the 50 to 59 year old group. With regard to the childhood vaccinations, I know those vaccines, which are a smaller dose compared to the adult dose of the Pfizer mRNA vaccine, 10 micrograms instead of 30 micrograms, they're due in the country within the next 10 days or so. And, you know, they should be in individuals' arms, subject to parental and guardian consent, the day after. There should be no real delay. I mean, we've seen currently, and it's no...
So you're saying, you know, we shouldn't wait for NIAC to advise on this?
Oh, well, I think NIAC should give their decision beforehand. I mean, they've had plenty of notice that this is coming. The EMA have approved it without actually knowing what NIAC look at. It's probably the same data that the EMA are looking at. I think we need a very agile decision making process from NIAC, which, you know, it gives the decision before those vaccines are actually in the country. I'm sure Paul Reid and his colleagues are actually looking at the logistics of giving this. But, you know, if we have to, we bring in the army. We use every resource. I'm sure, you know, nurses and doctors who are kind of, you know, maybe have, God knows, a little free time. But, you know, there would be a volunteer capacity. You know, the call for Ireland that was made, you know, there was such a kind of response to that. I think there would be no delay in getting enough individuals to volunteer time to actually give these vaccines out. We've seen that it's reduced the hospitalisation rate and the illness rate in those that have actually got access to the booster. So, you know, with Omicron coming, like, as I said, we're not sure whether it's going to be, you know, replace Delta and be a bit more benign, because now we've seen it's picked up some of the flu sequences, and that it's kind of on its trajectory to becoming kind of a winter flu type illness, that, you know, we need as many people boosted. Even if that booster doesn't match the Omicron variant precisely, and that we have some loss in immune protection, you know, with the booster, we have many fold more antibody protection compared to when we even got the two shots or the one shot.
And just sorry to cut across to you, Liam, in relation to that, the age-based rollout that we're on at the moment, is there a case to be made for revising that to take into account, you know, people who got particularly, I think, the Janssen vaccine and also the AstraZeneca vaccine? You know, they've been hearing stories about very dramatic fall-offs in their level of protection now. Should they be put ahead in the queue?
Okay, just to give you some sense of where the highest figures are currently, Katie, we know they're in the 5 to 12-year-olds, but they're also in the 35 to 44-year-olds. And they're probably the parents of individuals who are in school, maybe bringing some of the, you know, COVID home. So I would advocate for the portal to be opened up to everybody as quickly as possible so that we can have the biggest social dividend with respect to these boosters. We saw last week there were queues in City Hall, there were queues in Cork here for people wanting to get their booster. We've heard of stories of people being turned away from vaccination centres because they're a couple of days early from their, you know, their six-month window or, you know, and I would also ask for that to be brought back to 4 months so that we can kind of get everybody protected as quickly as possible. And that has the positive effect of protecting the hospital, keeping people at work and reducing the incidence of this in our country, which is very high at the moment.
Okay, okay. Will you stay on the line with us, please, Professor Fanning? I just want to open this out to the panel. Maybe put a couple of the points that were made there to you, Colin Brophy. Like the science behind where we're going with this and the restrictions that were introduced and the fact that there was no talk of ventilation in yesterday's tranche of measures that were being discussed.
Well, just to look at a couple of things on it. The first is in terms of all the restrictions that were talked about yesterday and in terms of general health restrictions that we've been following from the very start, one of the overarching guidelines for that is that you are reducing contact. And all the science backs up that the only real safe way is to reduce human contact. And that has implications. It has implications for businesses. It has implications for people's social lives. It has implications for families. It's implications right across the board. Government is very aware of that when it's bringing in these restrictions. But the more you bring in those and the more people are willing to adhere to that and to look at their own number of contacts, it's been shown so clearly that that has a huge impact on the actual transmissibility of the virus. Then right across a number of areas, in terms of things like ventilation, I mean, I was listening earlier on to the earlier show on Radio 1, and I mean, one of the business owners there was making the point that they've provided increased ventilation in their premises. It's something I would encourage everybody who can to do. But we have to remember one key thing on ventilation.
Do we not have standards so people know what they should be doing?
Well, the key standard that you can have in terms of ventilation that's the most successful is actually to have air movement, is to have, even if it's only a small amount of a window open or a small amount of air moving through, that's the key best on ventilation. And then obviously where you can't do that...
So we are still back at throw open a window. That's our advice.
When you can't do that in terms of areas like schools and education and everything, there is a group already within the department that's there to assist schools and looking at how, if there is ventilation issues, they can assist on that. So I think we have to remember a lot of things can be done through our own good decisions and through our own good management. And there is plenty of support there from the government. I think there's probably the most expansive and supportive programme of any country in Europe in terms of trying to help people right across business communities and other areas in terms of dealing with when restrictions have to be brought in.
You've been shaking your head there, Owen.
Yeah, look, I genuinely think it's very frustrating when you hear government figures almost throw the responsibility back on individual members of
that's
the public.
That's not what I did, Owen. Now, that is not what I did.
Can I say this?
That is not what I did, and I'm not going to allow you to ascribe to me something I did not do.
Given where we are today, Colin, given the level of frustration that's out there, I don't think anybody wants politicians shouting over each other. You're deliberately trying to stop me from making the point I was going to make. There is far too much in what the government is saying, which is throwing the responsibility back onto ordinary people for months and months and months. Expert groups set up by government, opposition politicians, and business and principals and parents have been urging government to do a number of things. So, for example, HEPA filters should be in every school in the country, and they've had months to do it, and they have failed. And as a result, we have had some of the greatest outbreaks of COVID in our schools. That has been transmitted to parents exactly as we've just heard, and that is at the very epicentre of why we're in the mess we're in now. The same is with antigen testing. Again, the government set up an expert group. They advised the widespread use of antigen testing. The HSE has a drawdown contract currently to access 25,000 antigen, 25 million antigen tests, and they've only used
but
about
2
million.
But they were, to be fair, getting contrary advice from NPHET in relation to antigen testing. My point is
they set up an expert group, they got the advice. So one of the reasons we're in the mess we're in today is, yes, we have a new variant and we have to be very, very careful and we absolutely have to observe the public health advice. But government has been far, far too slow, whether it's on tackling schools, whether it's on HEPA filters, whether it's on antigen tests. And all of a sudden to say, businesses should go and do something and people should restrict their contacts. Yes, we should all do those things. But if government isn't doing its part of the job, then I have to say...
I'll let you back in a moment.
I have to say, when Micheál Martin says he's frustrated too, people are frustrated with the government for not putting in place the protections that they should have done for months.
Jennifer Whitmore.
I just want to go back first to something that Colm had said, that the fundamental principle here is that we know that COVID is transmitted through contact, and reducing contact is the key thing. Now, I'd be interested in what Professor Fanning says, because my understanding is that the science says that that is not the case any longer. And so if that's the government's fundamental philosophy on this, I can see why we're in the mess that we're in at the moment. In relation to putting back the responsibility on the public, when the Taoiseach made his presentation or his speech yesterday, it was about restrictions. It's about telling the public and businesses what they can no longer do. There was no mention of what the government is going to do to help. So when we talk about businesses, where are the financial supports for businesses that some of them have only been open for 3 weeks and they now look like that they're going to be forced to close? Where is the support in relation to ventilation? What do businesses understand about ventilation for their premises? Have they had any guidance on it? There is no financial support for them to actually get ventilation systems into their premises. And also in regards to the schools, again, you know, the opposition and Social Democrats have been calling for ventilation or for air filtration for schools for months and months and months now. And the government has been ignoring that, but they've also been ignoring their own advisors in this regard. And we've seen Professor Wenger is out in the media and he's saying that it absolutely should be
done. Well, they're getting two sets of advice, as I understand, and they're choosing to take.
Well, they're getting two sets of advice, but there was a specific committee set up that has expertise in that area. So I would think that that expertise, plus all the other countries that are rolling this out, New Zealand are actually putting filtration units into their schools at the moment. So it is happening all across the world. We had one of our expert groups who are specifically expert in this area have also advised.
I just wanted, before I go back to you, Minister, I just want to ask that question of Professor Liam Fanning. Do you think there is a fundamental misunderstanding at this point in the management of the pandemic about how the virus is transmitted?
Okay, well, the ECDC have very clear language on how this virus is spread. So if we take it outside of Ireland for a moment, it's spread mainly via respiratory droplets, including aerosols, from an infected person who sneezes, coughs, speaks. And droplets, including aerosols.
But is the government still focusing so much on actual direct contact? And
yeah. Well, direct contact is part of the equation. But, I mean, direct contact, you know, if I'm sitting a metre away from somebody and I'm speaking, we'll say, loudly, and you're kind of, you know, there's a lot of laughter going on, the force with which you expel air and with those viruses are expelled from you actually travel a little bit further. It is a respiratory virus that's spread by droplets, including aerosols. So they travel further. Sorry, I just need to take a drop of water myself, actually. So, you know, and it doesn't really survive on surfaces. We know that as well. Like, so I think there's, you know, needs to be an acknowledgement that it's the aerosol spread that is the key spreader.
Okay.
I don't think that disagrees, by the way, with what I'm saying. I mean, where the evidence is clearly there is the more you expose yourself through contacts, whether you're in rooms, whether you're in gatherings, whether you're in large groups. I think there was some very good points.
But isn't the point that if we say we make 50%, sorry, and I'll let you off then, but the fact that, I'm just this point, which is a very, very key fundamental point, that if the kind of restrictions we bring in are as blunt as 50% for all events, 50% capacity for all events, where some rooms it might be much safer to have full capacity in, and there's other rooms where 50% is still very unsafe, but that we're not taking into account the places this is spread. We're still talking about in terms of numbers of people in the one place.
Well, I think when you're trying to deal with a pandemic and you're trying to deal with a situation like this, you have to bring in a set of regulations. I think no matter what government in the world, no matter what country there is, there will always be variations, there will always be different. There's no such thing as a perfect regulation. There's no such way as regulating for every single individual room size, room height, square footage. So you have to try and put in place guidelines. But the one thing that really is important, just because I wouldn't like it to go out by any type of misstatement today, is if you do cut down your amount of contacts, you increase your own safety. And that is really important. And the more we can over these few weeks, because realistically, everything that the government does, everything that everybody in society has done, and everybody in society is really frustrated at going through, or the thought of going through, a second Christmas, restrictions and everything. But everything we're all doing and the impacts that's having is all about trying to make sure that we keep ourselves safe. And that still hasn't changed from day one. Now.
Okay, now Jennifer, you mentioned business support.
Business thing,
I'm going to bring in. I want to bring in Elena Fitzgerald Kane, president of the Irish Hotels Federation. Elena, did the government go far enough in your view in terms of the business supports announced yesterday to help your industry in the situation it now finds itself?
Good afternoon, Katie, to you and your colleagues. No, I suppose, is the one word answer there. Yesterday was a very dark day for tourism and hospitality and for Ireland in general. And I suppose what we've seen on, you know, with the narrative and not necessarily the restrictions is over the last few weeks, there's been a tsunami of events-led cancellations. Yesterday's announcement was a hammer blow on top of that. And I suppose, look, we understand it's part of a general effort to safeguard public health and we want to play our part. But if you're sitting where I am in the tourism and hospitality community, it's huge. Like in hotels and guest houses alone, 92 million in cancellation. That's about over 100,000 on average per hotel. It's half a million in my own hotel. And the key thing about December is it normally offsets the early part of the new year. But these aren't normal times. The outlook is poor. It's 30% occupancy for January and February. That's one in all 10 hotel rooms sold. So really, government have been fantastic in terms of going the distance. And can I just compliment, you know, so many TDs have been really, really fantastic and senators over the last few weeks in terms of supporting us. But we were assured of no cliff edge. And yet that is where we find ourselves now.
Colin Brophy.
Well, I don't...
The one thing you promised the hospitality industry, they now find themselves facing it.
Yeah, well, I don't accept that there is a cliff edge. I mean, there's been a huge number of supports brought in by government which were announced. The Taoiseach went through a number of them. Pascal Dunne, who is Minister for Finance, I know has been in direct contact with groups as well on this. And there is supports there. Let's look at the ongoing set of supports. There's the continuation of the 9% VAT rate. There's the extension of the rates waiver. Most importantly, there is support for businesses who are affected by the new regulations to enable them to, while they're still trading, to actually receive support. And I think that's really an important part of it.
Not the employment wage subsidy scheme, which Elena's members will say is crucial for them not closing up forever.
Yeah, well, the employment wage subsidy scheme, which is... It is a huge, huge scheme. And I think probably one of the most generous and supportive schemes that's been there from any country in Europe or indeed any Western country operating a support scheme. So it was brought in, and remember we're talking about costs of over $1 billion running these things, was brought in at a period of time when we were facing huge shutdowns, huge closedowns, large-scale potential unemployment. We now have a situation where we have a large number of sectors who are actually have very solid performances, not affected by government regulations. They're not affected particularly by the pandemic. But for the industries that are, for the hospitality industry, and indeed, I worked before I was elected a TD, so I have a better understanding than most TDs about that, because I worked in hospitality. I worked in the event management industry. That was my entire livelihood for over 20 years. So I have a real understanding of my many friends and colleagues who are still in that business and what they're going through. And I think the supports that the government have announced in this area, it'll meet most of what's required in terms of supporting them. And I think it's a very, very good announcement by government in terms of ensuring that those supports are there for the industry.
Oh, no, Brian.
I have to say, people are losing their jobs. Businesses are going to close because in the same week we have the reintroduction of restrictions. The wage subsidy scheme rates were cut and cut very, very significantly. And the whole point of a wage subsidy scheme is to keep people connected to their employer. Businesses were already reducing the hours of their staff in the last number of weeks because of voluntary cancellations on foot of the messages government was putting out. So the first thing government needs to do is immediately reinstate the wage subsidy scheme levels that were cut this week. They also need to make it clear that they'll run till the end of the year and they will be reviewed beyond that, because this isn't just about businesses. This is about people who cannot get back to work. This is about artists. It's about staff in restaurants, etc. And with respect to the pandemic unemployment payment, because while we did get an announcement last night, although short on detail, that it was going to be reopened, yes. Who will it be reopened for? Because what we also need to understand is when you reduce hospitality and entertainment, that has an impact on taxi drivers. It has an impact on a whole range of other ancillary industries and workers, and it needs to be expanded to all of those people affected.
Well, the department will go through the full details that, in terms of that, but the rollout will obviously be towards people affected by closures.
Directly affected, not people affected by closures. Just mentioned
but I mean, you have to look at what is the actual totality of supports that are there right across the board, and I think it is really important to recognise that.
Okay, with respect, Miss, you have made that point, and you were given time to make that point. Can I just ask you, Elena, will you be attending that meeting with Catherine Martin and Leo Varadkar with other stakeholders on Monday?
My colleague Tim is, and can I just say, look, we do welcome the rates waiver and I do welcome the CRSS. I'm concerned about the cap. I think what's been put in place really favours smaller businesses, and it doesn't. I suppose the very core of what we're trying to do is to keep our teams together, you know, to pivot ourselves for recovery. And putting the EWSS back at November levels was the key lever for doing that. There's also anomaly within the EWSS right now, so that if you can't claim the EWSS in December, what it actually means is that you're automatically disqualified for the first 4 months of the year. There are very tough few months ahead. There's 270,000 people in tourism and hospitality. There's obviously entertainment sectors and the others. There are whole communities built around tourism. And I suppose for me, the big thing is, you know, tourism has contributed 2 billion in exchequer returns every year before this pandemic. There is a 4 billion contingency fund there. We want livelihoods supported. We were the first to fall, the hardest hit, we were the last to recover. And, you know, government have gone the distance with us. But the reality is, are we going to fall short now with the final furlong? Because it's livelihoods, it's the ability for people to pay their mortgages. And that's the piece that's missing.
Jennifer.
Yeah, I just want to make the point that, you know, it should be the case that the second government makes a decision on restrictions, that the information is available for people so that they can fully understand what it's going to mean from them, whether it's from a social or financial perspective. So it is not acceptable for businesses to be wondering, well, what does this mean for me? OK, there should be information available. The second...
Well, there was.
I'm sorry, but that's not correct to say that.
There is absolutely information.
OK, so last week,
so
the government...
Colin, let Jennifer back.
Please don't talk over me. Okay?
I'm not talking over you. I'm just correcting what you're saying,
Colin,
which is not correct.
Colin, you are talking over me, so please stop, OK? The department last week made a call in relation to masks. Next week, they're coming out with the frequently asked questions for schools, so schools know what that means for them. Every time we go through a phase like this, it's like it's a big surprise to the government. The government needs to have a plan, it needs to prepare, and it needs to understand the part of this virus is that there will be variants and that we need to be able to act very, very quickly when those variants come on the scene. Not that everyone is scrambling to get the information together for people. This information should be done proactively. It should be available straight away. Businesses should fully understand what supports will be there and what it means for them.
A little bit of switcheroo going on there in the middle of that contribution. In relation to businesses being aware, last night there was very clearly initial statements made as to what would be, which is what I am reiterating here. Indeed, I know that Minister Donoghue has already indicated and later made reference to it in terms of the cap, which we fully recognise, the 5,000 cap in relation to the bigger hotels, that bigger side, that will absolutely be looked
but
at
in relation to
as
like
well.
The PUP
but
payments,
in relation to PUP, the general outline and all the information comes out as soon as possible.
So you have to be
reasonable about this, and politicians scoring points on it isn't being reasonable. What the situation is that you have effectively, say, a government reacting to, as well as what we are going through, but Omicron coming on the scene, something that no one was talking about even a week and a half ago. So there'll always be tweaks, there'll always be developments, there'll always be necessity. And I think if people just trying to score a political point by saying you don't have every last T crossed and I dotted on the night you make an announcement, when the general information is provided on the same night, well, I mean, that is either a lack of understanding of how things work are not just trying to be political about it. And I think that's a sad thing in the middle of a pandemic for us to be doing.
Okay, very quickly.
I have to say, Colin patronising other panelists and the public.
Oh, I didn't patronise. No,
patronising.
No, Colin,
Colin,
you did. Colin.
Colin patronising other panellists mm-hmm. and the public.
I didn't.
You did.
When he cannot defend a very legitimate point, which is today, people who aren't going to be able to go to work next week and the week after or will lose income because of that do not know. They simply do not know this weekend if they will be eligible for the pandemic unemployment payment or not, when it will open, etc. So I think it is entirely legitimate not to have every fine detail, but the core information should be made available. I mean, case after case, for example, the government made an announcement about PCR tests and antigen tests for international travel. People went and paid money for those tests. And then at midnight, the night before, the rules changed.
Yeah, like, that was indefensible now, Colm.
This is happening far too often, and Colm should accept it and accept that the government needs to learn from its mistakes to make sure we're not again in this position in a few months' time. That's a very reasonable request from the opposition, Colm.
And point I'll answer to Owen on that, and I'll answer to you as well. Absolutely, I think that was a mistake. I think that it was regrettable that that happened and that people had that mix up in terms of when they needed it. So I'm quite willing not to be scoring political points on stuff and to acknowledge when something doesn't go right or when something goes wrong. Likewise, I just ask everybody else to recognise and be reasonable. Because I think the public out there, by the way, are incredibly more reasonable because we're all going through this together. Every one of us is going through the same feelings of frustration and annoyance and anger and everything about facing into a Christmas with all of these. And I find the people who are contacting me are incredibly trying to just get the information, recognise that the situation changes so quickly. Yeah, when we make mistakes, we'll say it. But when, you know, I won't accept what I consider unfair criticism, and I think I have a right to say that.
OK, well, let's talk about children in school then, and we're talking about criticism, because there has been a lot of criticism about how that new edict went out this week that all children from third class up in primary school would now have to have face coverings. I see we have a note in here from John Boyle, the INTO president, saying that when HICWA last looked at age restrictions on face coverings in August, we had a daily average of 22 children aged 5 to 12 testing positive. When NPHET made their new recommendations for temporary lowering of the age to 9-year-olds on Tuesday, the number of kids in primary school age testing positive was averaging 880 a day. A 4,000% increase, and it's now even higher at nearly 1,000 children a day. I want to bring in Áine Lynch now, CEO of the National Parents Council. Good afternoon, Áine.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Parents received very short notice of this move this week to introduce face coverings for primary school aged children or some primary school aged children. What kind of reaction did you hear from parents?
Yeah, so I suppose we've had an unprecedented reaction is the only way that I can describe it. We've had thousands of parents contact us either by phoning us or emailing us, really confused as to why this has come in, very concerned for their children, particularly concerned for their children's anxiety levels, their social development skills. And really, I suppose that their main concern was why was it being brought in? They didn't feel that they had been given enough information to understand why their children now needed to wear masks when all through this pandemic that hasn't been required. So, I think that piece has been really difficult for parents.
Have any parents been in touch saying that their child was excluded from school because they didn't want to wear a mask?
No, we haven't heard of any child being excluded at this point. I mean, generally what we're hearing from schools is schools are doing their very best to manage the situation and at this point showing flexibility in how they're dealing with it. I mean, yeah, how long that goes on for, we're not sure, but at this point we're hearing that that's what's happening within schools.
There's been some mixed messaging along those lines, though, hasn't there, Ben, from government you know, it's some. I'm thinking of Josepha Madigan in particular. Yesterday, saying that it was advisory, not a requirement. But I understand that the department have come back after that and said it's absolutely a requirement.
Yeah, I mean, I think that does it does bring difficulties when there is mixed messaging out there, because I suppose people are hearing all sorts of different messages, and when parents have got concerns about putting a mask on their child, they will cling to any message that makes it sound like that they have some control over this situation. So it is causing more difficulty for parents. But I think, I mean, one of the things that we would really say is, I think better information needs to be given around this decision. I mean, from the point of National Parents Council, we're not public health experts, and we don't engage with whether decisions are right decisions or not, because we'd rely on the public health expertise to do that. But I think what parents really need to do is to get the understanding of why suddenly this has become the issue. So I suppose for them, they're telling us, you know, when the whole population was unvaccinated, when the hospitals were bursting at the seams, their children weren't being required to wear face masks. And in fact, it was being they were being told that it was inappropriate for under 13-year-olds to wear face masks. And now they're in a situation where, you know, over 90% of the population are vaccinated and our hospitals are not bursting at the seams. And they're being told now that it is appropriate for them to wear face masks from 9 years up. So I think they're very confused with those messages. And when they're confused and also feel that they don't want to put masks on their children for their own concern reasons, then that leads to anger in a lot of cases. And I think that's what we're hearing very much.
And we're being told that this is going to be reviewed in February. Is that playing well with parents? Are they getting comfort from that?
No, I think they feel that if their child is struggling with this, that February is an awful long time away to be saying to a child, well, look, we'll look at it again. I mean, for 2.5 months away for a young child to say it's going to be looked at again, then that's a very long time in a child's life when they're not comfortable with something that's happening to them. So, I mean, we would very much feel that should be reviewed at the Christmas break and have a look then and see what's happening. I mean, we're being told quite regularly now that we'll know more in 2 or 3 weeks' time in terms of the new variant. So it would seem like that would be a very good time to review it. And also to say, you know, we understand that the numbers have gone up and they're alarmingly so. But we would ask as well that other mitigating factors are considered. And I know I've been listening to the programme and HEPA filters have been talked about a lot. So, I mean, numbers going up, we need to see, are the masks going to be, in the way that a young child wears a mask, is that going to be the most effective way of dealing with this? Or are there other mitigating ways of dealing with it?
OK, let me just put that issue of a review to the Minister, Colin Brophy. Would that make sense, that there would be a review of this at Christmas when we have more information about how this Omicron variant might be affecting us?
Well, I mean, all of these things are judgment calls. I can only speak for what I think about it, which is I think that would be a very, very short time frame to do a review of something. Schools are going to finish relatively soon. I think if you're doing a review, you'd probably get a better review by the proposed date in February than you would get by doing a review at Christmas. That's my personal view. I suppose the other thing
people are worried about now is, will the schools open up at all in January?
Well, I believe the schools will open up in January. I haven't heard anything to the contrary of that. Every time I have been in a radio studio or a TV studio in the interregnum between school terms, there have always been people saying the schools won't reopen, but they have so far successfully. I think for our children, and I think most parents and teachers and school education providers would like to see the school system operating and opening normally. I think there are issues around, obviously, children wearing masks, and everyone acknowledges that. It's a difficult thing to ask young children to do. I'd like to particularly acknowledge the work of all the parents and the school principals and teachers who have worked to get this going, and I think very, very successfully in the last few days around the communication of it. Yeah, there was, there was things around compulsory or not, or a recommendation or not, which could have been done better at the very start. But I think overall, real tribute to the educators and principals on its implementation.
Okay, we'll take a break there. We'll be back with more after these.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And we're still talking about COVID and those new restrictions that were introduced yesterday. I just wanted to bring up the issue of contact tracing, because we'd been told since the start of this contact tracing was incredibly important. I had my own experience of COVID in recent weeks, and I got my text and I was asked to provide contact, my own close contacts. But when you followed that, when you clicked on that link, it took you to a page that only offered you a choice of saying, I have no close contacts. And I thought that was just a glitch in that system. I had to go, gone to great lengths then with a HSE helpline to actually verbally give those close contacts. When I tried to do the same thing for a member of my household a few days later, same thing. You tried to give the close contacts, but it was offering you only a box that was tickable to say, I have no close contacts. And when you look at that NPHET letter that was issued to the government last night, it says that as of the 25th of November, the number of close contacts referred through this pathway, this is to get the antigen tests out to your close contacts, an average of 3,868 tests dispatched daily for the previous 7 days. That's from 7 days from the 25th of November. Should we know we're looking at 5,000 cases We know most people have more than one close contact, and yet there is less antigen tests going out than there are cases. So does that not indicate that there is a huge a problem here, a significant problem here in how the close contacts, like, has it just collapsed?
No, I don't. I don't think it has collapsed. And I'm going to start by saying that I don't know. I'm not an expert on this at all. So I'm going to handle it in terms of an answer to you the same way you did in terms of citing something personal. I know a lot of people who've been contacted with close contacts and who've got those messages and whatever, and who've actually then just used their own antigen testing kits that they've bought themselves. Now, that's entirely anecdotal. That's me just going on what people have said to me. I wonder how much of that is caused by that, because I literally know that to be the case. They got the text, they looked at it, they said, well, why get them to send out an antigen kit? I'll just do my own antigen testing.
But is it not automatic that once the HSE is informed of your close contacts, then they go in, it's supposed to be an automatic system. Hang on, let me just add, maybe they send a text,
but I don't think they, certainly the people have showed me the texts, they send the text, but I don't know if they automatically send the kit.
Oh, I see what you mean. That people get the text and they say, look, I'll use my own.
And they use their own. Yeah, okay. they use
so
their own.
So you think that might be discrepancy?
I think that could be.
I think I still have Professor Liam Fanning on the line. Do I, Professor Fanning?
You do, yeah.
Close contacts, this system, do you think that is still working well and in the way that we need it to be working at this point of the pandemic?
Well, one piece of evidence that kind of suggests that it's under exceptional pressure is that the CIDR weekly, or the data that's taken from CIDR for the 14-day report, has been taken offline, and data on likely source of transmission is no longer included in the reports, and the report is on a weekly basis only. And if you looked at the data before this was taken offline, especially the couple of days immediately before it was taken offline, in the days immediately before, so the 3 to 4 days immediately before, greater than 90% of cases had unknown sources of transmission. And if you look back over the last 14 days before that, nearly 40 to 50% of individuals had no known, or they hadn't categorised them with respect to mechanism of transmission. I think there's a large number of individuals where there is no knowledge of how they got their infection being recorded. So that would seem to indicate that the tracing system is under serious pressure with respect to kind of managing this pandemic.
Okay, I just want to move on as well to that other issue that emerged from yesterday's cabinet meeting. The issue of we were told that it was very tense, that there was some very tense and intense discussions in relation in particular to how some information had got into the public domain. And now we're told that there's this new edict has gone out that members of NPHET will have to get prior approval, basically, from the government press office before they will be allowed to make media appearances. Do you know, I mean, can I just say, we're a bit confused about that in this programme, because we would always have had to go through the Department of Health before a member of NPHET could be invited or would be asked to appear on this programme. So we're wondering what has changed there.
Well, what's changed is, first of all, I don't know. There's lots of media reports about what happens at Cabinet. Not being a Cabinet Minister, I'm unaware of
what happens. It's a bit ironic, though, isn't it, that we're getting a leak from Cabinet about people in Cabinet giving out about leaking.
Listen, when it comes to leaking, there's ironies all over the place. But I think what happened is that the decision was made that, in terms of the same as with myself, I mean, if I'm appearing on media shows, it goes through the GIS, and I think what they've done is they've decided on a centralised approach. I actually think that's the right thing to do.
But as I'm saying, we always went through the department.
Yeah, but the difference is it's going through the GIS rather than the individual department. And I think a centralised approach to communicating the message is vital. In actual fact, if you think about it, so many people in opposition parties and in media have been making the point consistently that they don't want mixed messaging and that they want it as coordinated and as central as possible. Okay. So this is to facilitate that.
This is a really important point, because unless there is a clarity of message, it leads to all sorts of confusion. There is an irony, and it's not a funny irony, that a cabinet that leaks like a sieve is complaining that NPHET documentation was leaked to the media. Nobody benefits from any of that information coming out by tweet. So I absolutely support the idea of having a properly controlled public message. But what I would also say is, all of NPHET's public health advice should be made public, all of it. And what I would fear...
But it is, though, is it not? I mean, we have this incredibly detailed letter that we get every time that advice
absolutely. And all I'm saying is, and I'm not making any accusation against any member of government, what I don't want to see is in an attempt to restrict leaks on the NPHET side, that there is any attempt to restrict the publication of public health advice, because that should be in the public arena. But okay. I'd really like to see the cabinet itself stop leaking and stop counter-briefing against itself and NPHET. And that's in the newspapers this morning, and that's not helpful either.
And there is that line that was at the briefing last night where the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar suggested or stated that he would like to see an external peer review of NPHET modelling, which seems an extraordinary thing to say,
it was an extraordinary thing, I think, for the Taoiseach to say. I do think that with any of this data and modelling, that there should be transparency with it. I think it will always benefit.
Do you think he's a point, though? I mean, do you think that there are questions around?
Yeah, look, I think with any data, if any scientist will always welcome a review of their data. I mean, and the more review and the more input, the stronger it is. So I think we shouldn't shy, and the government shouldn't shy away from that. There should be an examination and analysis of the advice that's going. I do want to make a point in relation to the messaging, because I suppose, having this restriction on NPHET, I think it is good that we're going to have hopefully one voice, but it does need to be clear. And I think the government has not to date managed to get a clear message. Okay. I think it's clear that lady, the Parents' Council, there is a lot of confusion out there amongst parents at the moment. And I do think there needs to be coherent, clear messaging.
We need to take a break. We're going to be talking about Mike after these.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
Now, the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, said on Countrywide on Radio 1 this morning that the MICA redress scheme will provide 100% redress for homeowners and will be updated by February to reflect market costs. Is that your understanding of the scheme, Ona Brenn?
Well, it's not just not my understanding of the scheme. It's not what's in the published document from the Minister on Tuesday. The issue of costs has been dealt with in reference to a calculator that's produced by the Society of Chartered Surveyors of Ireland. So it's a very reliable and up-to-date calculator. You go onto that calculator today, it will tell you the cost per square foot of building a home is €150. What is in the document Darragh O'Brien published on Tuesday isn't €150. It's €145 for the first 1,000 square feet. Then it drops to 110 and then to 100. So not only is it not 100% redress, so Charlie McConnellogue is just wrong, but also figures provided by the MICA Action Group, who were directly involved in trying to negotiate an improved scheme, show very, very clearly that, in fact, all categories of homeowners won't get 100%, and the average house that is affected will probably have to pay about €75,000. What Charlie is saying is clearly the SCSI's calculator is updated annually to take into account inflation.
Yeah, he's saying that the figures in the document that was released this week were indicative.
Well, first of all, that's not what the document says, right? The document does say that the figures will be updated annually, but the point is that as it stands, nobody is getting 100% redress. It also has to be said that not only do we not get clarity for people in Donegal and Mayo, but all of the other counties that have submitted their documentation to the department who are waiting to hear if they're included, folks in Clare and Sligo, etc., they're still none the wiser either. So this is not the 100% redress scheme that is required or that government is claiming they delivered.
Okay, you were just talking there before the break about the need for clear messaging, Colin Brophy. This is all over the place.
Well, I think what the government has done is they've put together a very, very good scheme. I think what the minister has made absolutely clear is that in terms of looking at costs early next year, that the scheme will deliver 100%.
Just to be absolutely clear what we mean by that, are you saying that no homeowner will have to contribute any money to the rebuilding of their homes?
Well,
no matter what size of home they have.
My understanding is between the scheme that's there and between the willingness to look at the figures, again, the minister has indicated that as part of that cost review, there's a square footage review of costs of building costs to take place.
That was
every
a yes or no
months,
question
that,
now.
Every couple of months, that scheme therefore should be able to deliver 100% remediation
should
scheme
be able
for family,
to deliver.
For family
I'm
homes.
Saying, are you saying now today that as the minister very, very forcefully said this morning, as Minister McConnell, that no, that it will be 100%.
Well, that's what I believe. That's what I believe it will be, and I think that what was announced as the scheme and the clarification which the minister gave in terms of making sure to take account of those costs of housing costs, which I think is next February, that will mean that the scheme is 100% redress scheme. So, I mean, I know that Joe McHugh has done huge work on this. He wants to see 100% redress scheme. The scheme that's put in place there, I believe, by the government is designed to try and meet that. And
there's
I think
a lot
it
of
will.
Trying to meet that, I wants said, to see.
Will meet that.
And will I think, meet that. And it will be 100%.
And I think that that is what both, whether it's Joe McHugh or whether it's Charlie McConnellogue or whether it's the minister, that's what they're at
and
when they put that scheme in
and
place.
And you're comfortable with the taxpayer paying for every block and every square.
Well, no, I'm comfortable with the taxpayer and the government having to put in place a scheme like this, but I also want to see us in every single way we can go after the people that supplied defective materials and look at how we can recoup. But I think that's the job of the state to do that. And for people who are living in family homes and need to have those homes fixed and rectified,
they should get 100%.
That's what they should be getting.
Okay, that's all we have time for today, I'm afraid. Thank you to all my guests. Thank you for listening. The programme was produced by Mary O'Hagan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon and Dave Gibson was on sound. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and stay tuned for Saturday Sports with Joanne Cantwell.